Hey, are you here? Well, if you are, it is my duty and my honor and my pleasure to welcome you to episode number 1004 of the Paul Leslie Hour. You know, a great writer named Robert Edwin McCready said, "We care about the tradition of things. We are explorers, pulling together the stories and artifacts." These words are a great segue to introduce this episode. We are pleased to welcome author Douglas Young to his fourth appearance on the show. He's released his new book, This Little Opinion, plus $1.50 will buy you a Coke, a collection of essays. Paul and Dr. Young talk all about it at La Belle Vie in Suwanee, Georgia. Hey, speaking of $1.50, maybe you'd like to make a contribution to help keep the Paul Leslie Hour going. Yeah, simply visit www.thepaulleslie.com/support and give yourself and others the gift of stories. You'll see a way to donate with PayPal, Venmo, or Cash App. And we thank you in advance for the Coke. And now let's get to it, shall we?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're here at La Belle Vie in the beautiful state of Georgia. I'm sitting down. This is, I believe, our fourth interview. Dr. Douglas Young, he has a new book. It's a collection of essays. Hold it up, please. This Little Opinion, plus $1.50 will buy you a Coke. A collection of essays, and maybe in 2024, there should be a little asterisk on the title that says inflation, depending on inflation. Well, Dr. Young, thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your opinions.
Thank you so very much, Paul, for having me. I am so honored to be here. It's always a joy to talk with you. We've been friends for a very long time, and it was a blessing for me to have you as a student in one of my classes many, many years ago. And I love watching your podcasts, listening to them, because like Dick Cavett, one of my all-time favorite interviewers, you are a master at posing really intelligent questions to your interview subjects and giving them the time to really pontificate and you know, flesh out their answers without interruption, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
That's very kind. Thank you. Now, you've expressed your opinions over and over. and it's an important thing, but why do you think it's important to do that?
I find that I can refine my thoughts about any topic so much better if I write them down. I find that when I am writing something, when I'm expressing my views on the computer screen, that forces me to have to think through them much more thoroughly than if I'm just thinking about any topic or conversing about it with someone. But when I'm writing, especially if I'm writing for publication, and most particularly if I am writing about an issue, a public policy matter, and so I'm trying to persuade my readers to come to my point of view, I have to anticipate all kinds of rational as well as emotional counterarguments, and that forces me to reassess all of my ideas, all of my assumptions, and I'm imposing a much more rigorous testing of my thoughts than I do in conversation or just thinking or writing just personal notes. And so I think that to write an opinionated essay, and the standard length for most newspapers and publications is usually about 800 words or so, sometimes less than that, I think it's a wonderful vehicle to force one to think much more critically, analytically, and rigorously about whatever the topic. And the fact that traditionally, to get an essay published in this country, it needs to be fairly short, 800 words tops usually, that compels me to do an enormous amount of editing, to get rid of, you know, any excess word here, unnecessary verbiage or clause or phrase or paragraph there, to get rid of all the fat and gristle and just, you know, get it down to the absolute essential, you know, meat of the argument. And I find that essays, without exception, every time an editor ever told me, oh, it's too long, you have to, you know, cut so many words, initially my reaction is almost always, oh, no, there's nothing to cut. Oh, no, it doesn't need it. But without exception, every time I have reduced an essay's length, it has been made better because I kept all the core arguments, and it forces you to prioritize your arguments and present only the best, the strongest, and develop those. Always a shorter essay has been more effective, I think. So for me, writing essays is the best way I know how to really refine and test my ideas, to really put them to the ultimate test.
Now, Dr. Young, there's a quite a number of essays in there. I've enjoyed reading all of them.
Oh, thank
you. And some of them, admittedly, it'd been so many years, I wasn't exactly familiar. And then as I was reading, I would start thinking, I remember this news story. You know, some of them were from when I was just a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say that there is a piece that has been most successful?
I think I know which essay has been reprinted the most,
which
and by
one?
Far. The one about Ernesto Che Guevara. I wrote that in December of 2008. I remember I was in the throes of sciatica in my right leg, and I had to write much of it on my knees. That was the most comfortable way I could write it at the time. And it was first published in January of 2009. And since then, I don't know how many publications around the world have picked it up. And I'm pleased with the essay. I think it's well written, but I certainly don't think it's my best. But my guess as to why that essay has apparently resonated with more people than any other is because for most of my life, Che Guevara has been a major pop cultural and political hero of so many people, particularly on the left. But I dare say that so many young people who are wearing that iconic, handsome young revolutionary image of Che on their T-shirts, I dare say a lot of those young folks don't even know who he is or really care. But when you examine, when I've examined the real Che Guevara, if you read a good biography about him or a good article about him, man, this guy was a mass-murdering Stalinist totalitarian, a racist, someone who was terribly bigoted against homosexuals, a rank hypocrite. I mean, I think that Che Guevara is the most overrated political figure, arguably, of the last 50, 60 years. And so my sense is that maybe a great many people who know about the real Che were delighted to read that somebody had finally written a piece that was examining the facts of his life and was pointing out just what an abject failure he was in so many respects, what a hypocrite he was. So I think that that's my theory as to why that particular essay seems to have caught on and really, resonated with so many folks.
sometimes a writer or a painter or musician, whatever, they can't really see the magic of a particular piece because they created it.
Mm.
I remember that piece when it first came out.
Oh, okay.
So maybe you don't see something about it, but it's a very good essay.
Oh, thanks.
And again, you know, how many people walking around with a Che shirt, if you quizzed them just a little about his resume, could answer some of the, or would be shocked to know. But I just wanted to throw that in there.
My guess is that so many of the young people I see wearing that shirt, usually young teens or young guys in their early 20s, I wonder how many of them know that Che helped ban rock music in Cuba. He jailed people for merely being homosexual.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I remember.
What's that? I don't have, sorry.
I remember in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president the first time, in a Obama campaign headquarters, I want to say somewhere in Texas, there was a poster of Che Guevara on the wall. And, you know, how many of the volunteers at that campaign headquarters knew that Che Guevara totally opposed any kind of Western liberal democracy?
Yeah.
And so many of the views that are sacred to liberals.
Yeah. One of the other essays, we're recording this in 2024, the year of this book's release. You wrote about supporting DeSantis 2024.
Yes.
At the time, he was still being considered for U.S. president. Do you think the Republican voters made a good decision this time around? I mean, we're pretty sure where this is going in terms of the nominee. What are your thoughts?
I still believe that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis could make an outstanding president. I think that his gubernatorial record in Florida has been nothing short of phenomenal. I believe that he has most all the virtues of Donald Trump, courage, willing to take on the entire leftist ruling class. But DeSantis does not have what I see as so many of the vices of Donald Trump. I think DeSantis is a much more disciplined individual, and DeSantis, I don't think, has nearly the baggage that Donald Trump has. I have no doubt that the news media would, the dominant leftist news media would really be extremely critical of DeSantis, but I think that DeSantis is just not nearly as polarizing a figure as Donald Trump. DeSantis, I think, has been much more successful legislatively as a chief executive in Florida than President Trump was as president. And to be fair, Donald Trump had to deal with a lot more Democrats in the national legislature than Ron DeSantis has had to deal with in the Florida legislature.
Hey, how are y'all?
Hi. Oh, thank you. Aren't you sweet?
No
thank
problem.
Thank you so much.
We ate inside.
Oh, you already ate. Oh, you're just out here. Oh, okay.
Right.
Do you want to keep the water?
I wouldn't mind.
Okay, right. Thank
That's
you.
Very
no
good.
Problem. There's nothing being in here. Okay?
All right. Thank you very so much.
But I think that DeSantis also is more electable than Trump. I think that because he doesn't have all the built-in, there's just not nearly as much built-in antipathy towards DeSantis nationwide as there is towards Trump. I don't think that many people are going to change their minds about Donald Trump. I think people have a pretty fixed opinion about him, pro or con. I think a lot more independent and moderate voters would be willing to give DeSantis a chance. But having said all that, let me readily confess, in 2016, when Donald Trump ran for president for the first time, I was very skeptical of him because he had given a lot of money to Democratic as well as Republican politicians over the years. I didn't think that he was remotely qualified to be president. I still don't think of the presidency as an entry-level position for politicians. And boy, did he prove me wrong. I mean, policy-wise, I agree with most everything Trump did, and especially regarding his judicial appointments. I think that all three of his U.S. Supreme Court appointments are just terrific, and the appointments he made to the federal circuit courts of appeals and federal district courts have been remarkable. So if Trump is elected for a second time, only the second president, you know, the first since Grover Cleveland to pull off that feat, I am confident that he can be a good president. And Trump certainly has a lot more charisma than DeSantis. Trump has a lot more experience dealing with the National Press Corps and, you know, international diplomacy than DeSantis. So I certainly will enthusiastically vote for Trump. I just wish that he didn't have quite as much, as one person has put it, diarrhea of the mouth. I wish that Trump was more disciplined. I love what one of Louisiana's U.S. Senators, John Kennedy, has said. He told Tucker Carlson one time years ago that he had told President Trump that not tweeting will not kill him, that it's not essential that he tweet. So in any event, that's an overly long answer perhaps, but I do feel very good about having supported DeSantis, but I also am quite comfortable supporting Trump.
Are you optimistic about the future?
Overall, yes, with many caveats. I think that my travels in China and being blessed to know many wonderful Chinese through my lovely sweet Cheyenne, I draw a great deal of comfort from the fact that the people of China, after having endured 27 years of the most brutal totalitarian dictatorship in history, that of Mao Zedong, communist dictator from 1949 until his death in 1976, I am really comforted by the fact that after that hellish dystopian nightmare, the Chinese, over the last not quite half a century, have created a society that is light years more economically successful and opportunity rich and educated and free than any the Chinese have ever enjoyed. And I certainly would love for the Chinese communist dictatorship to rapidly evolve into a Western liberal democracy. But they have come so far so fast, and I'm thinking if they can turn around their country from such a nightmarish situation to one where the Chinese today have undreamt of prosperity and opportunity and education and freedom, personal freedom too, not nearly as much as we have, but way more than they've ever had. If they can do that, you know, no matter how badly we screw up, I think that we can come back too. And we have some wonderful blessings that the Chinese do not have, in that we have this fantastic self-correcting system of government that our founding fathers gave us, with checks and balances and separation of powers. And so we have a wonderful almost 250-year history of correcting our mistakes. When we go too far in one direction, the pendulum swings back to the other. It's almost impossible for any one group, much less one man, to dominate our government too much, because of the, you know, the legislative branch versus the executive branch versus the judicial branch, and with all the frequent elections we have, and so many factions, as Madison called them, now we call them interest groups, checking and balancing each other. And I think also, as magnificent a novel as George Orwell's 1984 is, I think it's the best political book ever written. And I think it's every bit as relevant today as it was when it was first published around 1950. I think that Orwell may have been mistaken in believing that technology is going to be used as a great tool, serve as a great advantage for oppressive dictators. I think, particularly regarding communications technology, with the internet and all the thousands and thousands of news sites that have been made possible thanks to that, with satellite television, with talk radio, with all the information technology we have now, iPhones, I think that it's harder than ever for dictators or wannabe dictators to keep people ignorant about what's really going on. There are so many alternative sources of news now, and I don't know how you censor the internet. I mean, acquaintances of mine in China can buy what they call, I think it's over the firewall technology where they can get around the Chinese government internet censors. And so I think that we're living in a time when individuals, completely non-famous folk, people who are not affluent, can make YouTube videos, can make podcasts, can have their own internet website. I mean, it's more possible now than ever before for most everyone to make sure that his or her voice is heard. And so I think that's exciting. And we're learning that, contrary to the doomsdayers warning us about, oh, we're running out of oil and we're running out of this resource and that resource, with ever more technological advances, we're learning that, no, we've got way more oil than we ever imagined. And so I think that there's a growing skepticism in the country towards the whole ruling class. I think people see how wrong the ruling class got the whole COVID mess, how ridiculous and destructive the lockdowns were. And so I think that as a conservatarian, a conservative libertarian, that gives me more hope that it will be much harder for the government to fool people and to coerce people into doing what is unnecessary and even counterproductive the next time we have another big bogeyman epidemic or whatever is the new enemy to come along.
Not limited to the book, what opinion have you changed the most in your life?
The first thing that comes to mind would be abortion. I'm ashamed to say that when I was young, I not only favored abortion rights, but I wrote an essay that I revised a few times. I mean, it ran in several publications, and it was stridently pro-abortion rights. I started to have some serious doubts when the technology was improving and ever earlier in the pregnancy, with sonograms, we could make out ever more remarkably human-looking forms were in mothers' wombs. But what really was quite a revelation to me was when many years ago, when I was visiting Chicago and I was in the Field Museum, this magnificent natural history museum. It's got a big shark's fin on the top of it. And I went into this room all by myself, and it was jet black with these little display cases, little glass display cases, and in each one was an exact replica of a human fetus or embryo. And there were maybe about 9 of them. You saw these fetuses in different stages of fetal development, and I was just mesmerized because I was stunned at how early in the pregnancy you can clearly make out a little human being, a little baby. And I looked closely and you could make out all the individual fingers and even all the individual little fingernails. And it was just, it was overwhelming. And I realized, my gosh, these are the most innocent of God's children of all. Wow. And I thought more about it and I realized, you know, we don't declare someone dead until his heart has stopped beating. Well, how can we say that this little fella, this little gal, is not a live human being when his or her heart is still is beating? And that's a, you know, that's a human heart. So I think the abortion issue changed me more than anything. When I was young, I saw the opposition to abortion as being dominated by religious fanatics, wanting to control people's lives, particularly young women. And I was not looking at remotely the full picture. And not to make excuses, but to just try to understand why I believed as I did when I was young about abortion. When I was young, we didn't have remotely as advanced types of sonograms that we have now. And we were told that in the first trimester of pregnancy, oh, you know, you got this little formless blob in the womb. And we didn't think that it really became sort of a human being until much later in the pregnancy. And you know, for a long time now, we realize that that's just wrong. And my views on abortion have become all the more conservative in recent years with the fact that the Democratic Party has now come out in favor of abortions for all 9 months of the pregnancy, funded by taxpayers on demand. I mean, we've even had folks like the former Democratic governor of Virginia, Northam, argue that, oh, well, even if a baby's born but the mother doesn't want it, that it should be allowed to die. And that's just profoundly disturbing. And so I don't identify with the pro-abortion rights movement anymore. So I think that would be probably the biggest issue on which I've had a, not just a change, but an almost 180-degree change.
Well, Dr. Young, congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to meet you, and even if it's just to have creme brulee French toast, which we each got that. It was wonderful. In our last moment here, before we get going, if you could hold up the book.
Sure, thank you.
What do you hope someone takes away from reading this little opinion plus $1.50 will buy you a Coke?
I hope these 65 essays about a terrific variety of public policy issues, politicians, and other political phenomena, I hope they will encourage people to think about more issues that really affect our lives in terms of public policy and the people who try to impose those policies on us. I hope it'll encourage more people to think about all this very seriously and to always re-examine our views, whatever they are. I mean, someone said, I wish I could remember who, that if you haven't changed any of your views in a really long time, you better check your pulse because you may not be alive. I mean, I think that we should never be afraid to expose ourselves to different perspectives. We can always learn from others, even if we totally disagree with them. If we understand their arguments more, we can, first of all, appreciate that, hey, you know, they're not evil people. They just have different life experiences, different, they were reared differently. They have had different phenomena impact their lives. And, you know, all of that has colored their points of view. And maybe if we had walked in their moccasins, so to speak, we would have their views too. And if nothing else, we can learn how to better fine-tune and refine our own arguments to counteract their counter-arguments. I think that as I try to do in this book, I have an introduction to each essay providing historical and biographical context, because these essays go back to 1986, although most of them are much more recent than that. But I think this book illustrates the evolution of our politics from about 1986 to the present. It also shows my personal evolution. I went from being sort of a young liberal libertarian to a conservative libertarian. And I've gotten a lot more religious over the decades as well. And oftentimes in my introductions to some of these essays, I'll admit I got this wrong. You know, I was wrong about this guy, or I wish I hadn't emphasized A or B or C opinion so much, you know. So I think that it's always healthy to constantly subject whatever our views are to counter arguments, to seek out different opinions. And I think, provided that we're acting in good faith, we're trying to learn as much as we can about whatever issue is at hand, I think the better informed we are, the more knowledgeable we are, the greater the odds are that we can make the right choices. And I also think that it's healthy for people to be able to laugh at politics more. I think it's really good to have a lot of political satire, to not take politicians and certainly ourselves too seriously.
Dr. Young, a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm so grateful to you. I'm so honored to be interviewed by you. And thank you for all you do, providing so many outstanding interviews with so many fascinating people. I've enjoyed watching so many of your podcasts. And I wish you every success and happiness. May God bless and keep you forever.
God bless you.
Thank you.
We thank you and appreciate you dropping in for the Paul Leslie Hour today. You know, you can help the Paul Leslie Hour in our mission to provide independent media content like this by visiting www.thepaulleslie.com/support. We truly thank you. This is your announcer speaking. Performance of the Entertainer intro song and Corina Corina outro song, courtesy of John Premorano. Well, that's it for today. So until next time, be safe and be good.